Hey, good afternoon, everybody. So today we're going to talk about fish. A couple of things. I got a little bit of feedback from the last year we had about wine. So one thing that somebody said was that the story I told with Reb Chaim and supposedly the Telzer with that whole back and forth. So I got an email just like 10 minutes ago from a very chashuv Talmid Chacham in Lakewood, who the fellow that actually put out the Drushas Haran for art school. If you ever tried to learn a Drushas Haran, you appreciate how needed this is and how amazing of a work it is. But anyway, one of the things, Rabbi Kilson, one of the things that he said was like, it's a bit of a strange story, because if you want to demonstrate why you need Brisker Lumdus, that story doesn't really demonstrate why you need Brisker Lumdus. It just demonstrates why you have to open your eyes before you pass a halacha. You know, like you have to know what dam is. You have to know that you like, it's not really Brisker Lumdus. Okay, so anyway, but that story Rabbi Bleich printed in one of his volumes of Contemporary Halachic Problems. He has an essay called something like Halacha and Lamdus, the all about the intersection or the connection between Halacha and Lamdus. So Ayin Sham, and you can get that story, and it happens to be a fantastic article in general, but that's as far as that. Also, Yoni Rabinovich told me that there's on the Star K website that they say differently than I did about if a housekeeper moves a closed bottle of wine, that if she moves it and you're not there watching her move it, then the Star K is machmir, that you need to spill the whole thing out. So I couldn't figure out why they were machmir, unless they're assuming, which they seem to be assuming, that just moving it is called shichshuch, which I think we generally assume is not the case. The shichshuch of yayin is dafka shaking the wine with a purpose, not just that you happen to be transporting it. The Rishonim talk about transporting wine and that it doesn't aser. And I did hear it directly from Rav Shechter on a couple of occasions that's the case, that it's not called shichshuch if you just happen to be moving the wine. So I just wanted to make that clear. Yeah, of course, if it's mevushal, there's no issue. So assuming we're talking about non-mevushal. Also, the Starkey website did not say if they're willing to rely on that lakula. Meaning, of course, our minig is that if a guy ever comes in contact with non-mevushal wine, okay, just spill it out, right? No big deal, right? Meaning, we're not going to be so machmir on baltashchus or whatever, because you're doing it as a chumra, so it's not called baltashchus. But the example we gave was, what if it's Shemitah wine? So that's a serious thing. You can't. It's really yatzochum rasu kulasu. So they didn't talk about that case in the Star K website. I don't think they did. I clicked through very quickly, but I don't think they did. Okay, but today, yeah.
Is it a fully closed, never open bottle of
wine? No, corked. A corked bottle of wine. Now, today we're talking about fish. There are a number of issues to talk about fish. First of all, can you buy salmon at Costco? Right, that's the number one question I get in terms of fish. Number two, tuna. Is it kosher? What's the issue? Why is it that Ad Hayom Hazeh, Rabbi Yisrael Reisman Shlita on his Shabbos HaGadol Drasha reminds everyone that OU tuna is not kosher, right? And that supposedly Rabbi Belsky held that way as well. Rabbi Tendler certainly holds that way, right? So tuna. So that's issue number two, which we'll discuss a little bit about Hashem when we get to Bishul Akum later on in the year. But there are other issues aside from Bishul Akum that relate to tuna that are more fish-related issues. And the third thing, if we have time, we'll see if we get to it. If not, I'm just going to do this as a 10-minute halacha shiur today, is swordfish. This is a major machlokas between Rabbi Tendler and Rabbi Shechter. Not only Rabbi Tendler and Rabbi Shechter, they each represent previous doros that had what to say about this issue as well. But it got a little touchy with whatever. We can go through the whole maisa later, maybe. But let's start with the kashrus of fish. Now, I am not a fish expert, but I'm just going to give you the basics of what it says. If you learn through Siman Pei Gimel, it has most of the halachos of fish. There is a fish expert, by the way. I assume most of the major kashrus organizations have one. In the OU, Rabbi Chaim Goldberg is the fish guy. He knows about everything related to fish and is very up on the industry in terms of, you know, what's happening in the industry. So it's, you know, I always say not just I always say, everyone always says, that more important than what you know is who you know. Like, a lot of times you get these kinds of questions, it's important to know who the experts are. It's important to be able to have a connection, to know who to send the email to when you have these kinds of questions. Okay, but let's start at the beginning. So the Torah tells us, Parsha Shmini, that there are simanim of kosher animals and there are simanim of kosher fish, right? So the simanim of kosher animals that split hooves and chooses cud, the simanim of kosher fish are fins and scale. And the Torah then says, what about birds? The Torah lists 24 non-kosher birds. All other birds that are not in that list of 24 are kosher. Now, it's the only challenge we have with birds is identifying what those 24 are, which are the 24 that the Torah is telling us are not acceptable. So the Mishnah, Maseches Chulin, gives us a couple of features to help us identify what the kosher birds are. But the Rama writes in Yeridaya, Simin Pei Beis, that in order to eat a bird, it's not enough that it has one of those identifying features or all of those identifying features that the Mishnah talks about in Maseches Chulin. You need to have a specific tradition when it comes to a bird, that it's an acceptable bird. Another expert that works for the OU, Rabbi Chaim Loiki, is the world expert on weird birds, and he traveled the world trying to find Mesoras in different communities that particular birds are, have had an unbroken tradition that they would eat those birds. So that is the major crux of the issue when it comes to turkey. I was thinking about doing one shiur of the three things Rav Schachter won't eat, right? Turkey, veal, and milk. But maybe we'll just do milk. Maybe we'll just do milk tomorrow. We'll see. But anyway, that's as far as birds are concerned. But once the Rama says that about birds, that you need to have an unbroken mesora, so many of the achronim, the chayyadim, and the chazanish assume that animals, where l'chori you shouldn't need a mesora, because the Torah is very explicit about what makes an animal kosher. That's right there in the Chumash. But animals also, according to these achronim, require a mesora that we ate this animal. And that's why there's some controversy about the buffalo and the zebu and the giraffe and, these strange animals that people didn't typically eat. It is a misconception, I believe, that you can't eat giraffe because we don't know the makom hashchita. The makom hashchita on a giraffe is quite large. The reason we don't eat giraffe is either some sort of mesora issue or because they probably cost like 20 grand an animal and the meat is not that good because it's a very muscular animal. So for tough meat, you don't want to pay, whatever, for, $2,000 a plate for tough meat. So we don't, and a giraffe is an extremely strong animal. I wouldn't try to shecht it. You don't want to get too close. So that's, but that's the Mesorah issue as far as it relates to animals. What about fish? So fish certainly do not require a Mesorah. No one says that fish require a Mesorah as far as I know. In fact, the Mishnah Nida tells us that you don't even need both simanim. You only really need scales because every fish that has scales also has fins, and therefore all you need to see is the scales on the skin of the fish. The Gemara Nida Dafnan Alvin Beis raises the obvious question, Michdi, Anana Kaskeskesam Chinan, Snapir Dekos Rachman Al Amali. If anyway we're only going to look at the scales, why does the Torah tell me that you need to look for fins? Or why does the Torah tell me that fins are even a simon? They're not really a simon, because having fins alone does nothing for you, and having scales without fins does everything for you. So what's the point of the fins? Gemara suggests an answer, rejects the answer, ultimately Yagdil Torah V'yadir, that just adding to the richness of Torah by telling us this additional requirement. There is some nice drush on the topic. You can look in the writings of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Zichrono Livracha. He has some very nice piece of drush on the topic, but that's drush. As far as halacha is concerned, when you look at the scales, and there are scales there, that's all you really need. Now, do you have to actually see the scales? This is going to come into play, obviously, when it comes to a filleted fish. You go into Costco and you see something that's marked salmon, and it's already fully filleted, and there is no skin attached to the salmon. And I'm not talking about if it's packaged and has an OU on it, that you have no shilas. That means that there was a mashkiach there that saw the scales for you and saw them package it. Talking about the fresh salmon, not the frozen salmon, the fresh salmon that they'll sell at Costco. So is that something, how important an inyan is bedika simanim, is seeing the simanim versus just having a yediyah that it is the right min. So the Rambam in Sefer HaMitzvos Mitzvah Kuf Mem Tes says that it's a mitzvah saseh to check the animals for simanim and to see if it's kosher. And the Ravid says, no, it's not a mitzvah saseh, it's a lav haba, mechlal saseh, but it's not an actual mitzvah saseh. Now, if you assume like the Rambam, the Ragachavar in Hilchos Machlos Asuras raises a fundamental chakira. He says, what's the idea of bidika simanim? Is it that I have to know that this is a piece from the animal that has simanim, or do I actually have to examine the simanim? Meaning, is it an inyan to actually see the simanim, or is it just yediyah that this flesh is flesh of an animal that has such simanim? So the later achronim point out that l'chore it depends on two girsa'us in the Rambam. Our girsa in the Rambam is mitzvah saseh leida hasimanim shemavdilim ben bein behim avchayiv of bedag v'chagav. To leida, to know the simanim. Whereas in the Frankel edition of the Rambam, the old edition was that way. In the Frankel edition of the Rambam, which I guess is the older edition, it's a mitzvah to say livdok hasimanim. Ooh, that's a little bit different than leida. Livdok hasimanim. That one needs to actually check and examine the simanim personally. In fact, Sefer Achinuch, mitzvah Kufnun Gimel writes, va'over alev lo badak el sheraa ba hasimana echad v'samach alav. That if a person did not do the bedikas hasimanim, even if he later finds out that what he ate was in fact kosher, he has still been mevatel the mitzvah sasei of bedikas hasimanim. Now, some would probably try to formulate this chakira somewhat ironically as, what are simanim? Are simanim a simin or are they a siva? So it's funny to ask if simanim are a simin, right? But that's why it's an ironic formulation. But if they're just a simin, then all I need to know is that this is from a type of animal that's a kosher animal. But if it's a siva, if the simanim are these characteristics, let's not call them a simanim, let's call them characteristics. If these characteristics are what makes the animal kosher, so then it could be that you have to see that these characteristics are there. But that, you know, it's still an imperfect formulation because it's hard to imagine that examining is a siba. You know, that I have to examine it, that's what makes it kosher. The presence of the simanim is the siba. Once you know that it's a cow or a sheep, you know that it had those simanim, right? So it's an inexact formulation. Now, the Darkei Tshuva and Simen Pei Gimel in Yerdei, Simen Pei Gimel is the simen on fish. There's only, whereas when it comes to Yayin, we said there are a whole bunch of simanim, over a dozen simanim in Shulchan Aruch. Dagim is one simen, Simen Pei Gimel in Yerdei. So in Simen Pei Gimel, the Darkei Tshuva writes that it can't actually be a mitzvah to examine the simanim of every animal. It has to be that you just have to know that it's the correct species and that what you're eating is kosher. Because the Rambam in the beginning of Hilchos Machlos Asuras says, mitzvah saseh livdok hasimanim shemavdilim ben bein behema v'chaya v'of v'dag. V'of? Oaf doesn't even have simanim. What does it mean? That there's a mitzvah say to be bodik, the simanim of an oaf? Elamai, what the Rambam's telling us is that you have to know. You have to know if it's kosher or not. So he formulates that as livdok hasimanim, but it can't be that it's a mitzvah d'oraisa to be bodik simanim of an oaf, because mi d'oraisa, there are no simanim of an oaf. And Darkei Tshuva brings a further raya from the Gemara Navodzar Daf Lametes, because the Gemara tells us, quotes a brisa, Tan Rabbanon ein lo achshav va'asid legad l'achazman kigon asultanis va'avit hareza mutu, that if you have certain types of fish that don't have scales yet but they will grow scales, that's good enough, they're kosher right now. How could you be bodek simanim if it doesn't even have scales yet? So how could you possibly eat it? How could it be kosher right now? Elamai, you don't really have to be bodek the simanim. Apparently, all you need to know is that the species of fish that you're eating is kosher. And that's all you need in order to be mekayim this mitzvah asay. Now, if you're looking at a new species that you never saw before, then you have to look for the simanim. You can't just guess. So a fish fillet that you know is from a kosher fish should be fine. Question is, how do you ever know? You know, when it comes to chalav, let's say, so Ramesh's famous tshuva about chalav companies, because of the FDA regulations, and they cannot sell, and they have no benefit in selling, none of those chazakos and none of those rules apply to fish. In fact, Rabbi Goldberg from the OU said that the FDA actually released a statement a while back over 10 years ago, saying that it's come to our attention that there are people that are selling whatever it was, catfish, and calling it everything, whatever they, you know, they're getting catfish from Ecuador, and they're selling it under whatever whatever other name, and we plan on doing nothing about it, because, you know, it's all safe, it's fine, it's no one's going to get hurt by it, and we're too busy monitoring things that actually will be dangerous. So they know it's happening, it is happening, and people are always trying to make a buck and always trying to cheat the consumer. Yeah, but at the end of the day, there's no one really monitoring it very well. Every once in a while, there will be like, the catfish farmers of certain states will get together and they'll go to their congressmen or the senators and they'll say, oh, we need to pass legislation about catfish from Ecuador or something, you know. Okay, so every once in a while, there will be some movement because of some special interest. But other than that, you cannot trust just because it says something on the label that it is. You see a white fillet of fish, that could be anything. Yeah, it could be tilapia. Tilapia is often white. Or it could be something else. You have no idea just by looking at it what it is. Oh, Rav Meir Gabriel Elbas has a great mnemonic for Simon Pei Gimel. Simon that talks about fish and Shulchan Aruch is the initials of gefilte fish, gimel pei. Okay. What did Gabe send us? As often as 26-87% of the time for commonly swapped fish such as grouper, cod, and snapper, disguising fish that are less desirable, cheaper, or more readily available. Yeah, this is meaning this is not unheard of. This is something. So, like, how? What's that? It's a wide range. Yeah, 26-87%. Yeah, somewhere between 0 and 100% of the time. But even if it's 26%, that's a lot, right? So it's a real issue. So, and you can't. The person has no nemanus. The person that's presenting you with the fish has no nemanus that it is in fact kosher. It's a nachri who's marking the species, and a nachri is not neman on things of kashrus, right? That's what we learned the other day. That anyone is chashad al adavar, the Mishnah tells them, sechs b'charis, anyone is chashad al adavar is not neman on that matter. So he has no nemanus. So if you buy fish, you need to actually see the scales. Typically, when people would go to a non-kosher fish market or to a fish market that sold all different kinds of fish, including non-kosher fish, a Jew would always bring their own knife. They would see the scales. They would then tell the person at the fish market to use this knife to fillet the fish, and that's what they would do. And they would take home their kosher fish and make their gefilte fish for Shabbos or whatever. Right? That's what that was typically what was done. They quoted the name of Rav Meisha though. That when it comes to salmon and red trout, salmon and red trout are the only fish that have a pink flesh. So just seeing the pink flesh is enough, because you don't need to actually do bedikas simanim. You only need to know that it comes from a kosher fish. If it has pink flesh, it comes from a kosher fish. There are no non-kosher fish with that color flesh. And that's why many will allow, including Morena of Shechter Shlita, buying a filleted salmon from Costco, because it's salmon. You know it's salmon. What about the knife that they cut it with? Isn't it possible that they use that for non-kosher? So for that alone, all you would need to really do is rinse it. But even so, it's unlikely that they ever use the knives for non-kosher. I once went to the fish department in Costco, and I asked them, you know, where it all came from. They do nothing pretty much there on site. It all comes from wherever it comes from, wherever and the people that they're getting it from are the growers. So they're only dealing with salmon. They're not dealing with anything else. So you're really not risking too much. However, not everybody agrees with Rav Moshe. There are those that argue. Now, what do you mean you can artificially manipulate the color of the flesh based on the diet that you feed the fish? Farm-grown salmon used to have white flesh, and then they had to start feeding it a different diet to make it nice and pink, because no one wanted white salmon. That didn't feel like salmon, right? So, meaning if salmon from the wild was always pink because it ate things. It ate whatever sea creatures it needed, the carotenes, to get the carotenes that it got, that it absorbed into its flesh, and that it became this pinkish flesh. But farm-grown salmon, where they were feeding it whatever feed they had to feed it, to keep it healthy and to keep it to grow, was white, and then they they realized that they had to do something about that. They had to feed it a different diet. So apparently their flesh isn't naturally pink. It's only because it eats lots of seafood that the flesh becomes red as a result of the carotenes that it eats. And therefore, they adjusted the diet of the farm salmon, and that worked to change the color. So there were those that argue that apparently it's all about what you feed it. Any fish can become the color of salmon. So while naturally only salmon has that color, since it could happen to any fish, it's not a raya. So the OU did a study, and they realized that it's not really true, that other fish do not have a change of flesh color as a result of the carotenes that they eat, meaning if you were to feed other fish that same diet that they feed the salmon, in order for the salmon to develop pink flesh, the non-kosher fish would not turn, the flesh would not turn pink, because every fish stores the carotenes differently. Every creature does. The only fish that stores carotenes in the flesh are salmon. If you buy factory cut salmon, like at Costco, you don't even need to rinse it off, like we said. If you buy from a local fish store, then you would need to rinse it off, because they're using chafing knives to cut it. But that's the position, at least of Morenu Rav Shechter Shlita, right? Meaning there are other fish, it may change the color of their skin, it may change the color, it may do something else, but it's all a matter of how it processes it. Like, you know, they have like tanning pills or things like that, that will turn a person orange. I ain't president of the United States, right? Meaning that there are things but that's all the way a person absorbs that which they're ingesting. So apparently it only happens to kosher fish, it doesn't happen to non-kosher fish. That's as far as salmon is concerned. Question? Oh, yeah? Yeah, you should, yeah. Probably. Yeah, if you buy it at a regular fish store, you should rinse it for sure. Now, let's talk about canned tuna a little bit. This was a Leibedik discussion. I remember when I was a Talmud here, I was interested in the topic, so I asked Rav Shechter. At the time, not everything was available online yet, so I asked Rav Shechter for his opinion about it. He said, I wrote something about it. Let me just give you the article that I wrote. And he said, yeah, you could read the article that Rabbi Tendler wrote also. So he gave me his copy of Rabbi Tendler's article with his notes on the side and his own article. It was interesting, because it was fun to see his notes on the side of it, because you saw how he was processing what he was going to respond to each one. You know, at one point I just remember that Rabbi Tendler wrote something like "Ein lanu shum makar," you know, like there's no source that says, and you just have the whole side of the page just filled with makaros, you know, kidarka bekodesh, you know, that obviously he felt did address that particular issue. But let's talk about canned tuna. So on the boats that catch the tuna, there is no mashkiach usually to confirm that they all have scales. So Rav Henkin and Rav Meisha argued that based on that, you can't believe the Nachri, and you need a mashkiach timidi to examine every fish to make sure that it's not a tray for fish. In fact, some claimed that, ooh, if Rav Henkin paskined on this already, then you can't be makel anymore. That's it. Game over. It's, you know, the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, Dav Zayin Amud Aleph tells us, Hanisha lechacham ba'asar, lo yisha lechacham v'yatir. That once a chacham has been asked and he paskined the shayla and he said asar, you're not even allowed to go ask the shayla again. So forget about the merits of the argument. The argument's over. Rav Henkin paskined. He was a paisik adar. But Rav Shechter points out in his article that the Raman, Yardes, in Reish Membei, Siflam and Aleph, says that that only applies to the same cheftza that the hora'ah was made on. If it's on a different cheftza entirely, then you don't say that once you were nishal lechacham and he was matir, then you can't be nishal lechacham and be mekel. That's an interesting discussion, actually. I just had a shiloh last week. I discussed in my from the rabbi's desk shir. A guy told me he's a big Talmud of one of the Rebbeim in our yeshiva, very, very close Talmud, and he called with a nida shayla. His wife had done a hefsek tara 7 minutes after shkia. So he called his Rebbe, who he always, always calls, and his Rebbe wasn't available. He left him a message, I have a shayla, and a couple of hours passed, and his wife was getting a little antsy. She wanted to know the answer. So he remembered that his Rebbe once paid a nice compliment to a local Rav in the community where he lives. So he figured, okay, my Rebbe approves of this Rav. So he called that local Rav in the community where he lives. And the local Rav said, it's fine. He's a Ramesha person up until 9 minutes. It's Vadayon, or it's at least Svek Sveka. So you have Svek Sveka to rely on. It's fine. 7 minutes after Shkia is fine. Then his Rebbe called back afterwards. And his Rebbe said, you had a Shaila. And they were too embarrassed to say, asked and answered. Right? So they said, they just repeated the Shaila. They figured probably he'll say the same thing. And he very much did not. he said, no, no good. You got to do Hafsiktar again tomorrow. It's after Shkia. No good. So then he called me. He said, what do I do now? I got myself in this mess. So what do I do now? So that's a fascinating sugya. If you ask one Chacham. So that's the opposite. He was at Nishal Chacham Vihitir. And then it was, so the question, is it based on Shavya Nafshi Chaticha Di Yisura? Is it based on whatever it might be based on? But anyway, so there were those that argued that they're not even allowed to ask. Shailos Rav Shechter thought that is not at all the case, because every new tuna, none of the tuna fishes that were around at the time of Rav Henkin, hopefully, are still around nowadays. So he didn't paskin on any of the tunas that we have right now. The Marik points out that if you didn't say this way, if a chacham made a mistake, then all of Klal Yisrael would be doomed into keeping that mistake forever. Meaning, we have to be able to question that which people have paskin. Rabbeinu Tam would never have been allowed to argue on Rashi, the Marik writes. So, and not only that, there were other poskim from Rav Henkin's own generation that were cholek on him. Rav Aaron Kotler, Zichron Levracha, Rav Soloveitchik, Zichron Levracha. They were also cholek on him. So that's not a very strong argument. However, Chalkas Yaakov disagrees. With this chumrah of Rav Henkin anyway. The practice in Europe was always to have sardines. Now, the nature of canned sardines is that they pretty much came intact. So Chalkas Yaakov of Breish points out that the Ramo over here in Simen Pei Gimel Sif Zayin says that kirvei dogim einam nikachim elam mumcha. You can only buy from mumcha elim kein omelo hayisrael o oved kochav mamochram ani malach lemosisim midag tahar. Only if the Jew or non-Jew tells you that I'm the one that processed it and I took it and it came only from kosher fish. So the Shach wonders, how can you possibly believe in Nachri about such a thing? So Rabbi Breish says it must be that we rely on Uman Lomar Umnase, the Gemara in Avodah Zarah Lamed Dalet that we have. So the Gemara in Avodah Zarah says that Chilek Uman Mutter, and Rashi says that, what does that mean? It's a kosher fish that when it's very small has no fins, and when it grows larger, it develops fins and scales. So you can't buy it from a non-Jew, because when you catch it, the other treif of fish are caught together with it. But if it's from an uman, it's fine. And Rashi explains, why is it fine if you buy it from... I mean, it's stam to buy it from a non-Jew, you have to be choshish that maybe there are non-kosher mina mixed in with it. But if you're buying it from a... from an uman, it's fine. V'hai chilek uman, kivan du uman hu ubaki bedavar, mavdil ne'mena mishum delo chashiv taimo, makalkali leilu sultanus, umar leilu kule arbe. He wouldn't ruin his whole business and his whole supply by having the wrong things mixed in. So Rabbi Breish argued that he won't give you a treif of fish if his job depends on the integrity of the product. And the Mishnah Ksubas Chavav says that if a woman was kidnapped, she's Asur Labaila, but if they took her for ransom, then she's Muteris Labaila. Why? Because they wouldn't risk a loss of money to violate her. So Kavachomer over here, or whatever, not Kavachomer, similar notion over here. They wouldn't risk their whole Parnassa to give you the wrong product. That's if there's quality control, then it really would be a risk. In certain types of fish, you don't really have that. So the OU relies on this with the tuna fish. The guys on the boats are not at all interested in the treif of fish. They even throw out the wrong kinds of tunas. There's skipjack and I forgot what the other two are. There are three types of tunas that they're interested in, and the rest of them they throw back into the ocean. They then filter it out again at the cannery and cook the different types of tuna in different cookers. So the OU has done spot checks on it and samples of it, and they've never found anything other than tuna fish in the final product. It is a little bit surprising that Ramesha didn't accept this, because Ramesha is the Ede Yediyah person, right? Ramesha was willing to rely on Chalava companies, and over here they have very strong controls and systems in place to make sure that nothing but tuna gets mixed into the tuna. So l'chora, that should be good enough for Eidei Yediyah. Now, even though the Gemara says that you shouldn't buy crushed tuna where you can't identify what type of fish it is, the Beis Yosef and the Darkei Moshe here in Simpei Gimel both quoted Tosfos Rid that says that if a company only deals with tuna fish, since it's a kosher min, you can buy from the Nachri, even though Hachashar al-Davar has no ne'amanus, meaning it's a very powerful umdina. So some argue that, wait, not all tunas have scales. So Shach said it doesn't really matter because they only sell three types, and the others they use for dog food or cat food or whatever, they just throw them back. So because what they're looking for, every type of tuna that they're looking for has scales, that's good enough. Now, what if taka, a non-kosher fish, did make it through? Meaning, can you be absolutely certain that a non-kosher fish never ever makes it through? What if a non-kosher fish did make it through and ends up in a can? So we assume that the large majority of the cans, everyone would have to admit that the large majority of the cans are kosher fish. Called the parish miruva parish, and therefore you should be able to follow the rov. You don't have a chaticha rilas kabed, you don't have anything like that. It's not a davar sheminyan, it's crushed tuna, right? So l'chora you should be able to say called the parish miruva parish. The rivash in Simon Kuf Tzadi Beis says that you don't apply rov in these cases because he writes kevan shatara tzivsa livdok b'simanim. Meaning, apparently, the Rivash says the mitzvah bedikas simanim is to know with 100% certainty. Meaning, the whole mitzvah is don't rely on the rov. So, in general, in Yeridea, we have this concept: just rely on the rov. But the Rivash says we dafka have this mitzvah bedikas simanim to tell us not to rely on the rov. And the only exception to that is if it's not even shaykh that the non-kosher one will be here. You live in a region where non-kosher birds don't live. So, there may be non-kosher birds ba'olam, but they don't live in your neighborhood. They don't live in the climate that you're in or whatever. So that's where we would... that's where we would rely. But otherwise, you wouldn't rely on the rov. The Dvar Avram discusses why we don't count... let's leave that out. Now, so the OU argues, yeah, maybe that's true. What the Rivash says is correct, that we don't rely on a rov. But it's not even a miut that would have non-kosher. It's not even echad min ha'ela. Meaning they've tested thousands of them. They never once found a problem. So you can't discount the possibility that at some point there might be a problem, but it's less than one in a thousand. And for that, you don't, even the Rivash would agree, you don't have to be choshesh when it's less than one in a thousand. The raya is from the Rambam in Macholos Asuras Perek Aleph, where the Rambam goes through the simanim of birds, and then the Rambam concludes, "Lufi she'ein b'chol hamin ma'asurin min she'ein odoris, v'yesh bo echol mishos simanim elu, chus m'paris v'aznia, paris v'aznia, ein mitzuyim b'yishuv el b'mbaros, i'e yamar chokos ad ma'od, she'ein sof ha'yishuv." Meaning those birds don't fit the rules of the simanim, are not commonly found. So it's super far-fetched to think that they would ever be in this neighborhood, though clearly it's theoretically possible that you'll have the wrong kind of bird in your neighborhood. So we see that while maybe we can't follow a rove, but a super duper rove can be followed. And when it's not even Echad Min Ha'Elef, that's enough of a rove to follow, even in the sugya of Bedikas Simanim. There's a Chassam Sofer in a tshuva that's quoted by the Pesachei Tshuva in Hilchos Avelus, says case, this was apparently a very major concern. A couple of hundred years ago, everyone was afraid of being buried alive. This was like a big deal for people. So governments were making laws that you're not allowed to bury a person until he's been dead for 72 hours because you want to make sure he's dead. There are too many stories at people's funerals, whether they were true stories or not, where they hear a knocking from the inside of the coffin. Hey, everybody, I love what you're saying about me, but, I'm still here. Let me out. So people were very concerned about being buried alive. So they were the story in the Tshuva Chacham Sofer. They were burying a guy, and in you know, like in the walls of a cave or something, in a vault or something, and they heard knocking on one of the other kvarim, and they took the guy out. So the Chacham Sofer was asked, maybe we should tack away 3 days before burying all bodies to make sure that they're really dead. That was a major fear. So the Chacham Sofer says, now it does happen, maybe once in a long while, but it's so uncommon that you don't have to be choshesh. So how exactly are we magdir the what's called the rov and what's called the super rov and what's called the super duper rov and what? So those aren't halachic terminologies, right? So Rav Schechter points out in his article that there are 5 different levels of rov that we have, each with different, with nafkaminas on a daraisa level, the 5 different categories of rov, at least on a drabana level, most of them on a daraisa level as well. The lowest level of rov is what we'll call a rov garua. It's only 51%, where we don't even say Ruba v'chazaka Ruba adiv in such a case, because the principle of Ruba v'chazaka Ruba adiv is based on the idea that rov is a birur and chazaka is an anhaga. So the birur beats out anhaga. You don't need anhaga when you have a birur. That's Ruba v'chazaka Ruba adiv. But when it's such a tiny rov, it's very hard to call that a birur. Then even the rov would only be anhaga, so it wouldn't beat out chazaka. Then you have a rov bari, a healthier rov, a wider margin of victory, a 70% to 80%, that kind of a rov. That's where we say Ruba v'chazaka Ruba adif, meaning the rov is an overwhelming rov, but the mir is still a mir amatsui. It's still more than 10%. It's still a mir amatsui. So that's Ruba v'chazaka Ruba adif. Then you have a rov that's against the mir she'eno matsui, where the mir is so small that it's like an over 90% rov. The mir, if you go with the Mishnah Yaakov's definition of mir she'eno matsui, the mir is less than 10%. So where you have something like that, that you don't even have to check l'chadchila. You know, like if you know that that a particular manufacturer of suits, 95% of their suits are absolutely not shatness, so strictly speaking, you wouldn't have to check it for shatness because it's a miyut she'eino matsui. Where another nafkamina would be when it comes to shluchi mitzvah and inizakin, Rav Schechter points out that when the level of hezek is less than 10%, we would still apply the principle of shluchi mitzvah and inizakin. But the Gemara tells us in Maseches Pesachim, hey, the shchiach hezekah shayini. What's called shchiach hezekah? Shchiach is matzoi. Shchiach is that it's more than 10%. So if the miut is more than 10%, then we say, no, you're no longer going to have, on a daraisa level, you're no longer going to have the security of Shluchei Mitzvein and Nizakin. Then the fourth level of Rov is a 99% Rov, where it's a Miyuta de Miyuta. And the Rov goes up against a Miyuta de Miyuta, where even Rabbi Meir, who's Choshish the Miyuta, wouldn't be Choshish for a Miyuta de Miyuta. And even though we pask in Ein Holchen Mamanach HaRov, Rabbi Kiveger in Chuvas, Tinyana, Simon Kuf Gimel, Oz Tezvav says that we would be Holichach HaRov of 99%. A Miyuta de Miyuta, but a miyuta to miyuta, we are holchim b'mamanach harov. And then, on top of all that, better than a 99% rov, echad minei aleph. Echad minei aleph, you could even be meklam pikuach nefesh. Even in the case of pikuach nefesh, the Tshuvas Chacham Sofer, Yardeas, and Mishin Lamed Ches, says you don't have to be concerned. The Maram Shik, and Yardeya Sim Reish Memdala disagrees, because he, the Maram Shik writes that you need to do Metzitza on Shabbos, even if it's only Echad Min Ha'elef, that it would be dangerous not to do Metzitza. So it's Pikoch Nefesh, they got to do Metzitza. But we assume, like the Chasam Sofer, that as long as reasonable people aren't afraid of it, then it's not called Pikoch Nefesh. If the Pikoch Nefesh is in the 1% area, so Enoch and Pikoch Nefesh Acharov, and then absolutely you got to be machmir and inyan of pikuach nefesh. But if it's echad min ha'elef, then whether you're going to call that pikuach nefesh or not will really depend on whether people are frightened. And if people are frightened by it, then it will be pikuach nefesh. If normal people are not frightened by it, then it won't be pikuach nefesh. Which is, you know, some people don't like that hagdara because it leaves so much up to irrational people. But you know, you first have to get to that step that it's echad min ha'elef. Only then do we leave it up to what normal people are concerned about. So that's as far as rov is concerned. But then there's another issue when it comes to the tuna fish, and that is that other fish sometimes might come up in the net. So it's really the same concern, but we just took it from a rov perspective. The Gemara in Avodah Zarah, the Mishnah in Avodah Zarah, Daf Lamed Hey, tells us that these are tells us all the things that are machale yakum, and lists chilek. And the Gemara says, why is chilek aser? It's a kosher fish, and it says because it comes up together with non kosher fish as well. So the Gemara would seem to imply that even though there's almost no chance of it being a non-kosher, there's a specific Isra Dirabanan that whenever kosher and non-kosher fish are caught intermingled together, that there's an Isra Dirabanan, you're not allowed to use it. So forget the Isra Daraisa. Rove took care of the Daraisa problem, right? On a Daraisa level, you don't have to be kosher, you're actually eating non-kosher fish. But there's a special Isra Dirabanan for those fish that come together, that when you pull up the nets, you get kosher and non-kosher fish together. What do we do about that Isra Midrabanan? So Shachter pointed out that that's not really a fair assessment. If you look at the way the Rishonim discuss it and define chilek, like Rashi does, it's the phrase one in a thousand doesn't appear anywhere except for Rashi, including Rashi's own commentary on the Rif, with the exception of the Arzarua. So obviously most disagree with Rashi and on that particular issue, and they hold that when the probability is only one in a thousand, it doesn't even have a din derabanan. There is no din derabanan. Also, the Rashash in Masechta Sukkah discusses a fish called the shtinkis in Yiddish, and the Rashash writes that there very often when they would catch these shtinkis fish, they were intermingled with small non-kosher fish, which are difficult to distinguish from them, and everyone assumes that it's kosher. No one ever says anything. But the Rashash says you're allowed to have it. Why? Because Rashi in Avodah Zarah defines tzachanta as chilek, that has no fins and scales, but it will eventually grow the fins and scales and should therefore be kosher. So why did they asher them? Because when you have similar looking fish and none of them have scales, and even the kosher ones don't have scales because you have to wait till they get older and bigger to develop scales, so that's where you have the Isra Dirabanan. But if you have two fish that come up in a net and one of them has scales and the other one doesn't, that's not the Isra Dirabanan. When the tuna, whenever you catch the tuna already has its scales. So that's not an Isra Dirabanan. Furthermore, there are experts who are very capable of distinguishing the kosher chilek from the non-kosher fish, and the Gemara specifically says that that's fine. And if it's mina mumcha, the Gemara in Avodah Zarah Lamed Tes says, if you get it from an expert, then that's good. So whenever you're buying your tuna, you're buying it from experts, and that's all they do all day. So that's what the guidelines of the tuna industry are such that you could be fairly confident for their own financial interests. They have people who are processing the tuna who are constantly examining what's coming into the cannery to assure that they're processing only the albacore tuna, which has to have the exact standards that they're looking for. Not only that, the Mishnah is talking about a particular case of a particular kind of non-kosher fish that come up in a net together with kosher fish. That's where Rashi says that there was an Isra Dirabanan, because the entire mixture has thousandfold more more kosher fish than the non-kosher one. But in our case, there is no reason to believe that there's any non-kosher species present. Meaning, when you know that there are kosher, non-kosher species present, that's where there's Isra Dirabanan. But the fishermen, the factory workers, and the factory owners are very, very careful to package only albacore, and so it's an unfair comparison between the two cases where you know that there are non-kosher fish that constantly come up with it. So that's that's the basic argument that the OU has. Now, you can certainly understand the other side. The other side of the argument is, what do you mean? Gemara says, what difference does it make if it's this type of fish or that type of fish? If non-kosher fish come up in the net with kosher fish, then that's enough to constitute that is drabanan. And then there's the Bishel Akum issue related to tuna fish, that they cook it, they steam it before they can it, and then after it's in the can, they cook it in the liquid that it's in the can in. It's all done by Nachrim, usually, and therefore it seems to be a violation of Bishulei Nachrim. Right? The tuna fish that has, like Haimisha Ashkacha, is a special run that they send out, it must be, that they send out mashkichim onto the boats with the fishermen to make sure that only tuna is being brought in, and the mashkichim are the ones turning on the cookers to cook the fish. Now, what's the kula with Bishel Akum? So there are several kulas that they use. First of all, maybe now it's Nechel Kamo Shu Chai, because everyone eats sushi and sashimi, and people eat fish raw anyway. So maybe it's Nechel Kamo Shu Chai. Second of all, in Tshuvos Ruvos Ephraim, Chelkei, Siman Tavkuf Sadivav, he quotes from a Moshe that it's cooked by a factory, which is a very industrial setting. You would never be able to find the guy who cooked it for you, nor would you ever be able to find his daughter. And the whole list of Bishel Akum is because Gezeirah Mishum Chasnus. And there's no heter of Bishel Palter, right? We don't have such a heter. We have Pas Palter, not Bishel Palter, but a factory, Rav Meisha's quoted as saying, is different than a Palter. A factory is on a totally different level because it's not like the local bake shop. It's a factory where you would never be able to track down which factory worker cooked that for you. So if it's not even shaykh to track it down, so maybe that's not even called Bishel Akum. And that's a kula that they quote from Mamesha with an additional detail to explain why we don't say a low plug. Rav Greenblatt explains, Aval ba'ofen zeh, shemischamim min ha-beitzev al yidei mechonu betzura shekzu, sheli olam lamvash ha-mechonu zu ba'ofen sheyesh chshash kiru b'mtzius, yesh lo mashen lasser, mishum lo plug. Why don't I say lo plug? So betzura zu shel bishul yisrael in chshash shel chasnus yolam. Meaning, the equipment that they use to cook things in the factory are equipment that you would never find in a person's kitchen. I mean, you'd say low plug on a type of bishul that could be done in your neighbor's kitchen, or it could be done in a factory setting. That's where we would say a low plug. But we're not going to say a low plug on a type of bishul that could never have been done in anybody's kitchen. It can only be done in a factory. So that's the suggestion. In the Chidah, in Shiurei Bracha, in Yardei Asim Kuf Yud Beis, it says, Yesh lahakshel slechor mata matirin pas shel pas shel palter typically mishum shlakos. Why don't we say that every pas akum is really also bishul? So he says shlakos kufay mishum chasnos v'palter leka chasnos dibu umnaso osek. That you don't have to worry about chasnos when it's someone who's involved in his umnus, and therefore there is he suggested even is a heter of bishul palter. Okay, that's an out there shita. We don't even need to be mitzari for that. So what do we have so far? Why is the bishul akum mutter? Maybe it's nachol kmo shel chai. That's one. Second, it's factory. Third, it could be that tuna is eino olah al shulchan malachim, or canned food in general is eino olah al shulchan malachim, which is also a major heter when it comes to Bishel Akum. And finally, the way it's cooked is with steam. So maybe steam as a din of Mu'ushan. In fact, in the Minchas Yitzchak in Chela Gimel Simul Chavav, he writes, Achein, Heicha Shemesbashel Ma'yidei Kitur Yesh Gedolei Achronim Shesviru Ludein B'zeh Bishel Akum. He quotes that there are Gedolei Achronim that hold that steaming is not Bishel Akum. So none of those kulas may be enough to be Mekel on their own, but you put all four together and maybe that is enough. If I'm not mistaken, I think nowadays the OU does insist on a Jew helping in the cooking in some way anyway. So the Bishel Akum is not really the issue anymore. When tuna fish goes to Eretz Yisrael, they're makbid that a Jew pushes the entire cart into the oven. Meaning the real issue is not in the bishul stage. The real issue is on the fisherman stage. That's where mashkichim don't go out on these fishing boats for like a month. You know, like you're not going to... But when they bring it back to the factory, they could have a mashkiach there. So when they send tuna to Eretz Yisrael, they'll have an OU mashkiach push the whole thing into the oven, the whole cart into the oven, because it has to be Bishul Yisrael even by Sephardic standards when it goes to Eretz Yisrael, because most of the Jews, or at least 50% of the Jews in Eretz Yisrael, are Sephardic. In America, they're a little more makel about just a Jew playing a small role in the bishul. If Svardim are uncomfortable relying on the four kulas that we mentioned there, so then they wouldn't eat the tuna fish. Do we have time for swordfish? A few minutes for swordfish. Let's discuss it a little bit. So this got a little bit ugly. In the Jewish press a couple of years ago, Rav Shechter did an interview, a long interview with a fellow about halachic issues, and the fellow broke up the interview into different pieces. So like every week he was able to publish, you know, a different part of the conversation that he had with Rav Shechter. So in that interview, Rav Shechter was quoted as saying, and I quote, "The commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch say Dag HaCherev is kosher. It's widely considered not kosher because around 60 or 70 years ago, they asked Rabbi Tendler if he could make a list of which fish are kosher and which aren't. Rabbi Tendler decided to list swordfish as a treif of fish because he called up an expert who told him that the scales on a swordfish are a different consistency or something like that from those of other fish. So he decided it was a treif of fish, but that is absolutely not correct. Rabbi Tendler claims Dag HaCherev is actually a different type of fish, but it's not true. Rabbi Tendler did a service to the Orthodox community, however, because at the time there were conservative rabbis who were giving ashkachos. So he laughed them out of existence and said that they don't know what they're talking because swordfish is really treif. So the Orthodox realized that they can't rely on conservatives." So Rav Shechter's argument was, he's wrong about this issue, but it was highly effective because he made such a late sonus about anyone who says that swordfish is kosher that the conservative ashkachos that were saying swordfish is kosher became a big late sonus, and Mela, no one trusted the conservative ashkachos anymore. Ad kan, Rav Shechter's words in the Jewish press. Rav Tendler, in a shiur that he gave in Rabbi Rosner's shul in Nofei HaShemesh in Eretz Yisrael, gave a shiur on swordfish, and he responded to the, he read Rav Shechter's quotation, and he said, I believe the way he phrased it was, when Rav Shechter ran out of things to say, he chose to talk about swordfish. And he said that he was sitting with Rav Shechter at a chasna. He asked Rav Shechter, "Did you ever see a swordfish?" And Rav Shechter said, "No, I never saw a swordfish." And he said, "Well, then you can't paskan halach if you never saw a swordfish." Okay, so that's where you know. But what are the details? What are the issues? So there is a little history over here. In 1933, the Agudas HaRabbanim published a list of fish, and. And that was when it was under the leadership of Rav Blazer Silver, and swordfish was listed as one of the kosher fish. It didn't seem that that everyone always asked for swordfish. What's the background? So the Gemara in Maseches Chulin of Samach Vavim days tells us that a fish called an achsaftias is a kosher fish. So the word achsafti is not Hebrew, but it's an Aramaic type of version of a Greek word, and it seems to be that it's a reference to a swordfish. There's, you know, that some assume that it relates to a swordfish. The swordfish is not a particular, you know, there's a whole group of fish that have like sword-like things that are predatory, and you know, one might look at and say is a swordfish, but swordfish is unique because it's the way it's described, the way Rabbi Nathan Slifkin described it in an article that he wrote, is that whereas the bills of other billfish are round in cross-section like spears, that of swordfish are flat in cross-section like swords. Accordingly, any reference to a fish named sword presumably refers to the swordfish. He says, furthermore, swordfish are by far the most common of all billfish species in the Mediterranean. So Mestama, when the Gemara was talking about that, the Gemara was talking about swordfish. Then, in the 17th century, the Knesset HaGedola writes that there's a well-known widespread minhag for Jews to eat fish with the sword. The fish that has a sword, and he identifies the fish, even though it doesn't have any scales, because when it comes out of the water, it shakes violently, and it just throws off all of its scales. And later Achronim, the Prima Gadim, the Darkei Tshuva, the Chida, the Kavachayim, all quote this Knesset HaGedola. So apparently swordfish were eaten for a long time. And then when Rabbi Tendler did his research, he saw swordfish, he didn't see any scales, and he was convinced that it wasn't kosher. And even when he did see scales, he thought the scales just looked very different and were attached in a way that was very different than all other fish. And, ironically, I guess, Rav Waldenberg sided with Rabbi Tadner, meaning the Tzitz Eliezer, I say ironically because had other issues that they weren't so much on the same page about. So the Tzitz Eliezer sided with Rabbi Tadner. He also thought swordfish should not be kosher. And Rabbi Tadner said that when the Gemara was referring to this type of fish, it was not a swordfish at all. It was something else. Now, young swordfish, when they're about 4 feet long, have scales. Smaller scales with a single, the smaller ones with a single spine emerging from them, and larger ones with several spines. Now, those scales are not apparent in adults, not because they shed them when the fish are removed from the water, like the Knesset Gedolah said. No fish that we know of does that, has scales and then just loses all of its scales because it's shaking so violently. It's because when the swordfish becomes an adult, its skin gets thick around the scales so that they're barely detectable. You can barely see the scales. So if a fish has scales as a baby but then doesn't have them as an adult, so then that raises the question, are they kosher, right? The Gemara talks about the opposite way, that a fish as a baby, right? We quoted that Gemara earlier, that if a fish as a baby does not have scales and it grows scales later, so the Gemara says that that's kosher. So the Aruch HaShulchan says that the Gemara's heter, to eat fish that later grow scales, and fish that lose scales when you remove it from the ocean, that's the other case the Gemara has, that if you have fish that loses its scales when you remove it from the ocean, that's also kosher. So mistama, this is the same thing, right? The scales only have to be on this species at some point, but it doesn't have to be that it's there at every point. Meaning, it's not shaykh that when a swordfish is a baby, it's kosher, and then when it gets older, it's not kosher. Right? It can't be that it changes when it gets older. So it can't be that it starts life off as kosher and then becomes not kosher. So the real issue became and that seems to be pretty clear. The real issue became whether the scales of the swordfish are actually considered to be halakhically scales. The Rav Tendler argued, based on the Ramban al Torah, that scales have to be something that easily peels off and is not fully attached. And he said that that's always been the halacha. The Magen Mishnah, Machalas Asuros, and the Ramban, Yerodeus, and Pei Gimel seem to say that way. So Rabbi Tendler also says that the Rav agreed with him. So that's also a point of contention, because Rav Shechter and Divrei Rav says that the Rav did not agree with Rabbi Tendler, that the Rav held that swordfish are fine. So why don't we eat swordfish? Meaning, I remember when Rav Shechter, when this article was printed in the Jewish press, a guy came over to me in shul and said, like, so are we eating it? Like, can I go to the store and buy swordfish? Like, are you allowed to? So the answer is absolutely not. Why can you not eat swordfish? Because when you get it in the store, you don't see the skin, you don't see the scales, and you don't know that it's swordfish. It's not like salmon, where you have this idea of what it is. You have no idea what it is. It could be catfish that you're looking at. So they sell shark and call it swordfish. They could sell anything and call it swordfish. So that's a halacha, that you can't rely on it. So, okay, so I'll go fishing, and I'll catch myself a swordfish, and I'll see the scales on it, or I'll see that it is a swordfish. If I get an adult swordfish, I don't have to see the scales, and then I'll be able to eat it. Problem is that, to catch a 1,000-pound fish, I mean, these are enormous fish. To catch a 1,000-pound fish and then figure out a way to retail it on your own is not something that's likely going to happen. So at the end of the day, the whole conversation was really, it's all theoretical. Nobody's eating swordfish anyway. So it is possible to technically identify swordfish by other simanim, but most poskim say, you know, those other simanim are not mukhrach enough. You know, they have different swirls in their flesh or something like that. Most poskim assume that's not mukhrach enough. I remember when this article came out, we happened to have been sitting in the OU office, and Rabbi Shechter Shlita told us that he believes swordfish is really kosher. He said, Rabbi Tamla said it's not because the scales are a different shape, but it says in Yaradea that they don't have to be the same shape. And he points out that the way the Achronim understand Dag HaCherev, the Dag HaCherev is kosher, and Rabbi Tamla thought it was about something else. But then he told us, you can't eat it anyway, because the scales get covered over by the skin when it grows to its full length of 10 to 12 feet, so you'd never have a tefiyas ayin to know that it's the same fish. And they can't grow swordfish in ponds because they're too big, and they need to be grown in the wild. So it's just not shaykh. Then Rav Shach said he was upset about how it appeared in the newspaper that he was, you know, making fun of Rabbi Tandler. He felt badly about that. He didn't. That was not his intention. His intention was to argue in halacha. Rabbi Ganak seemed to recall that Rav Soloveitchik was matu the swordfish also. Rabbi Ganak was around the office that day. He said he seemed to recall that Rav Soloveitchik was matir. He also was not happy about the way it came out in the newspaper. So sometimes the best place to argue halacha is not necessarily the newspaper, because things can come out differently. But this is a major machlokas between Rabbi Tandler Shlita and Rabbi Shachter Shlita about whether swordfish is kasher, but it's all a halacha velo lemaisa. Meaning there are people like Rabbi Natan Slifkin, I'm sure, figured out a way to get swordfish. You know, like that's dafka, you know, something that he would figure out how to do because it's, you know, it's geschmack to figure that stuff out. But for the rank and file, for the rest of us, it doesn't seem to be really so much lemaisa. Okay. Yeah, sure.
What about baby swordfish, which have the skills? Is that common to catch a baby swordfish?
I don't think so.
So
there was a thought in the kashrus industry that sushi is specially processed before you. It's not really. They do almost nothing to it.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.